I am Claire Wilson James, and on August the 1st, my boyfriend and I, Tom Ekman and I, were, we had finished our anthropology quiz, and so we were out of class really early. We walked over to the student union, and we were drinking coffee with friends. We sat at the kind of politically active tables, like SDS and so forth. Would people like that would sit at those tables. And we looked at the clock and knew that we had to really quickly get a nickel in the meter. We parked over on East Campus, and we had to get a nickel in the meter because we already had two pink slips. And if we didn't, we wouldn't be allowed to park there anymore. And I was starting my eighth month of pregnancy, and if we had had to walk, it was a really uphill and very hot trek. And so we went to do that, and we were going to come right back and continue a conversation with friends. And we were walking across, and they were doing some kind of construction on the West Mall, where the Chuck Wagon is, the student union. And there were a lot of jackhammers going, and we were chatting. And then I heard all that noise, and I started falling, and I thought I was electrocuted, and Tom reached out to try to help me. He saw something was wrong because I was falling, and then he started falling too. I remember he said the word baby, and I'm not sure if he said what's wrong or anyway he expressed concern. I just remember the word baby, and then he didn't speak anything else. It was kind of one of those love at first sight things, you know. I just see Tom. I don't know how to explain. He looked like, you know, somebody my age, but I felt like I was 100 years old, kind of. I was 5 months pregnant, and I was, just considered myself. You know, I had worked for a student nonviolent coordinating committee in Mississippi, and I had the creds, and so I just considered myself. Oh, and I had decided that that I would never have love again in my life because, it was just not going to be anything that I could enjoy. And so I was reading this. He walked in, and I read him. He introduced himself, and I read him this quote about love can become shop-worn. And, in my 18 years old, I had decided that, that it was all over. And then there was a kid that we had, that the people who lived in that house had kind of taken under our wing, and he was in jail. He was a juvenile, and I don't know what he had done, but I asked Tom if he wanted to go with me to jail to try to get him out and talk to him. And so he tagged along, so I really guess I shouldn't say it was immediate, but by that evening, we were in love. And I didn't know what it was. I had no idea that there were guns involved because it was very deserted at the time because it was between classes. And I don't really remember seeing any other people. A lot of times people do say, well, you were the first one shot. I was the first one on the ground. His object was to get up and shoot a bunch of people. Along the way, he shot the receptionist, and he shot three people from a family that was touring and killed two of them. They were the Gabor family, and I thought that I first thought I was shocked. Then I thought there was some sort of invasion from outer space, because they explained to me later that when you lose a lot of blood, it feels like you're melting. And I felt like I was actually melting into the concrete. And so I thought for that reason it was some kind of, you know, gun from outer space. I kept staring at this one young man that was under the portico, maybe, at the steps of the administration building, at, you know, at the bottom of it. And he had his gray suit coat hitched over his shoulder, and he kind of looked like a Martin Sheen. He looked like Martin Sheen, and he was staring at me. Of course, I didn't know that person then or know of him. And he was staring, and I kept thinking, why doesn't he come help me? And he then ran down in the middle, and this was early on. He ran down in the middle, said, please let me help you. And I said, no, run away, you might get shot. You know, we'll all get shot. And so he went back, and I just thought it was so brave, and I thought it satisfied him. What he had to do, he did, you know. And they were speculating on us, and somebody said, we've got to get help for that pregnant woman. And somebody else yelled back, so that I could hear it. It was close enough that I could hear. And then somebody yelled back, no, we have to get the ones there's hope for. And so I thought, okay. Everything was shutting down. And so I felt very calm and pretty peaceful. You know, I just thought, you know, I just thought this is the end. And I never really had any idea of how. You know, I didn't believe in an afterlife or anything. I just thought things were just very calm for most of that time, until toward the end when I got very, very tired and just really wanted to just close my eyes. You know, I kept, you know, trying to figure out what was happening. And so then I thought, I heard the plane. I guess I did start hearing shots, and I thought the war in Vietnam has broken out, and it's you know, right here now. We're at war in the United States. And then I thought, then finally I heard at some point somebody yelling out, somebody's up in the tower shooting. And I was hearing people, I think what contributed to the war idea was I heard some people yell out for their mothers, you know, some men just yell out, Mama. Remember, I was looking up at the clock all the time. And, you know, I just watched the clock, you know, and heard every 15 minutes, you know, the little tune that it plays. And so I have very strongly in my mind, I don't know if it's fact or fiction, that it was 30 minutes in when Rita ran up. She was one of those amazing people that you know, had such a depth of love and humanity that she was able, you know, there's a Bible verse that says, greater love hath no man than that he will lay down his life for a friend. And I just thought that this woman and everything in her life exhibited that in their life to come. She just was selfless. I don't know. I would really like to know more about what made her the person that she was. But she ran up, she tried to help me standing up, and I was scared that she was going to draw attention, and I said, go away. And then I said, and she kept asking to help, I believe, and I said, lie down, you know, just lie down. And she did, and stayed there and talked to me and kept me conscious. This woman, that it turns out that we did have some connections, and we talked about those. And she never told anybody about it. On the day of her funeral, one of a person who worked with her until the end of her life, that's when she found out on the day of her funeral in 1996, 30 years later, and she was a good friend of mine and a good friend of Rita's, and that's when she found out was Rita's star pattern. When she was married, she was Rita Jones, and then when I knew her, and then she became Rita's star pattern. There's a kind of iconic fellow in Austin named John. His name was John Clay, and If you contact Dan Foster, who had a problem, I mean, I'm sorry, who had a program for a number of years on your station, he has a wife and they sing this ballad. And in it, I must have told John that we just talked about everyday things, you know. And we talked about, she asked me, you know, just who I knew, and we tried to make connections, and we found out that we both were in SDS, and you know, she asked me just the kind of things you would ask somebody when you meet them. I think I probably told her my blood type and Tom's name, and you know, she just chatted. She came to the hospital with a beautiful painting that it took me maybe a year or so to figure out that it was like looking inside a rose with all the petals, but it was blues and greens and turquoise, kind of a George O'Keefe style painting, an oil painting. And she brought that to me while I was in the hospital, but I never saw her again. When Artley came, oh, I was just so happy, because I thought I was going to die there, and that he came up, you know. It was just like there was hope, and I knew one of the guys, James Richard Love, had been in our anthropology class, and it was huge, and he had just probably a day or so before that been just totally reamed by the professor, because he used the word like instead of as when he asked a question. And here, a couple of days later, he's brave enough to run out there and pick me up, you know. And so I just, you know, I was just totally relieved and happy, and felt like there was a chance now, you know, to live. Once they got me to the ambulance or the hearse, I'm not sure what I went in. I remember the man who kind of took over, and there was just, I started drifting in and out, and the next thing I remembered was being at the hospital. And, but I was taken in. It was pretty intense. I was being, the first thing I remember is they're trying to cut off my dress and my not wanting them to, and they made me sign a paper saying they could operate on me, and I was pretty out of it. And there was an intern and a candy striper maybe at my head, and he was comforting her, and I was thinking, would somebody comfort me, you know? And then the wonderful obstetrician who was there, it was his first day of his residency, and he was actually off duty, but he came in, and he was trying to get a blood pressure, and I said, am I going to die? And he turned his face away, you know. And so I pretty much thought I was going to die. And then I don't remember this, but I've been told this, that they were trying to x-ray me. And then my doctor came up. I think I remember my doctor, Dr. Brian Forrester, came up and grabbed my gurney and Karen Griffith's gurney and said, there's not time to x-ray them. We need to get them in and start operating. And so he took us up, and they started operating on us. And 12 hours later, I came out of my first operation. And my friends, there were just dozens of them lining the hall as they pulled me down, calling out, I love you, Claire. We love you, Claire. And just being so beautiful. And then they pulled me into intensive care, and my mother was there, and you breathe very shallowly, or you used to anyway, after the anesthetic, and they were trying to get me to breathe. And I looked at Mama and I said, Mama, am I gonna die? And she said, of course you're not gonna die. Now breathe, do what the doctors say. And apparently they had told her there was maybe a 50-50 chance. But that's how my mother was. She was very commanding and very beautiful. And she just, for me, that was the best thing right then, to not have any idea of how bad it was. And so for the next 7 weeks, those nurses, I mean, they were just wonderful, just so engaging and loving and friendly for the most part. And my doctor dropped every single thing he did that summer. They said that he's no longer living, but they said that Brian Forrester and his wife, Dottie, had three children who perished in a fire. And I looked very young at the time. I tended to look about 12 when I was that age. And I had, because of lying in the sun for those 90 minutes, I had freckled. And they said I looked just like one of his daughters at the time. My hair was, before I lost so much in because of the antibiotics, it was blonder. And so I had freckles and looked just like somebody out of their family. And he just totally gave his every moment to me and did some very dangerous, very controversial. He did a very controversial surgery because he was convinced it's the only way that I would live, and had to kind of battle the hospital about it, but they acquiesced finally, and probably why I'm alive. When the bullet went in, it was a 6 millimeter, and it shattered my iliac crest and then fragmented inside. And so they had to do a lot of abdominal, take out an ovary, stitch together my uterus, and do lots of things. But there was that shattered bone that was inside me. And he proposed that they make a cut from my waist to the pubis and to just lay that open, just totally lay it open, and stuff it full of gauze and drip antibiotics through that and change it every 2 hours so that it would slowly close and heal up. It was huge. My mother said it looked like a side of roast beef. And but he took out all the bones that were shattered. And he later showed me an article in a medical journal that showed a similar person, and they'd left it in, and he had died from the infection. And but anyway, he felt that that was the way that I could live without complications. 3 months and 6 days. And five operations. The first one was 12. The next one was 11 hours a few days later. And then several others. And there was a remarkable physical therapist named Clay Gault, and G-A-U-L-T. I don't know if he's still living, but he had had polio as a child. And he taught me how to walk again. And I thought it was so moving that he was my therapist. I enrolled in school in January, right after, not long after that. And I still had open wounds then. I took a full load, but I only made it till about maybe mid-April. I don't know. I wasn't doing very well. I don't know how I was doing with school, but I was just, not strong enough yet. I would say that I've had a pretty wonderful life in general. And that was so huge, being shot there, losing Tom, losing my baby, that it's almost, I don't know, I just really maybe am not able to explain it yet, but the worst part of all of that was just the isolation and not being able to talk to other people about what had happened, because nobody else You know, we just, it's not like now where you can instantly, through social media or whatever, get in touch with everyone and all start talking about it. I did an interview with Dateline in 1999 that was aired in, it was aired in 1999, right before Y2K. And I thought, okay, now we're all going to get together, all of us survivors. You know, that was, 16, 17 years ago. And I thought, now we can get together. Not one call, nothing. Nobody connected after that. And I was just kind of heartbroken because I thought we'd get to explore what happened to us that day. And it didn't. And so I'd say one of the most healing things that ever happened to me was in... 3 years ago, I took about 7 friends with me. We were invited to do a tour of the tower, and it was specially crafted by the campus police and some other people. And when those people spoke, I had already talked to people, and I didn't feel such a need. But when they spoke, they pointed out that was the day they felt they lost their innocence. And they said that they never felt they had the right to talk about it because they weren't shot. And then when the policeman pointed out several times that he had 700 rounds and he could have killed so many, that's when, to me, it switched from my individual experience to a universal experience. And that had so much to do with the help of the media. And to be perfectly honest, I used to kind of envy the people at places like Columbine and the other places because they had a community that they could talk to about. And for example, Newtown, you know, that horrible tragedy, they are together. They've immediately started reaching out with different projects, you know, to do with mental health, gun safety, and so forth, whereas we were just kind of frozen in individual little islands, if you will. And so this has been very healing to me, but I can't say, I guess I need the healing because I'm getting it. You know, there is that isolation because I had this history that almost nobody else had. And to be able to, you know, at the end of my life, you know, at the later years of my life, to be able to come together with Keith and have it, and these other folks, you know, Gary, Forrest, everyone, to be able to, you know, kind of sum it up and say, well, you know, thanks to this and thanks to that, we can put this all together. You know, it's just healing. Yes, I'd like to make this in honor of my beautiful sister, Lucy, who also graduated from UT, or who graduated from UT. 4 of them did. I'm the only one who didn't. But anyway, she said that she looks at what happened to me like she uses the metaphor of a tree being struck by lightning. And, you know, when she said that, I looked at pictures on the web of trees that have been struck by lightning. Some of them are totally pulverized. Some are struck and have a really big scar and don't grow anymore. They're dead. You know, it's apparently gone all the way down into the roots and destroyed it. And some have a big scar. And I've got 2 really big scars on my body. And they have a big scar, but, you know, they're still living. And I felt, what a perfect analogy, because, you know, I did have this big thing that happened all at once. And yet, you know, because of the kindness of other people, the medical profession, and now media, you know, and all of the people who've been loving along my way. But because of that, you know, I've been able to live certainly a maimed life in more ways than one, but at least a life that I've been able to give some. And I'm just so thankful for the chance and so thankful for, you know, people being willing to talk about this.